Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Strike and Ellicott Files, an unofficial podcast dedicated to all things Cormoran Strike and Robin Ellicott, as written by Robert Galbraith. My name is Kenz.
I'm Lindsay.
And I'm Pools.
And today we'll be continuing our reread of The Running Grave, covering chapters 59 through 61 of part 4. Please be aware, as always, that our discussion of The Running Grave will often reference the ending of this book, as well as the rest of the books in the series.
All right, before we do our listener question, we have a really exciting announcement to make. We are coming up on our 100th episode of this podcast. Can you believe it?
Wow.
Incredible.
Amazing.
What episode number will that be, Kenz?
That will be episode 25.
To celebrate, we are doing our first ever giveaway.
Yay.
Yeah, so we're really excited to announce that we are giving away one of the official 10th anniversary special edition copies of The Cuckoo's Calling.
Wow.
I'm sure you all know the one and have seen the pictures. There are only 1,000 copies of these editions, so it's just a special copy for any Strike fan to have.
Mm-hmm.
But that is not all. I was contacted recently by our friends at the Rolling Library, and they want to donate one of their fan-made anniversary editions of The Cuckoo's Calling to also be given away.
Damn.
And if you've seen pictures of this, you know how exciting this is. It's gorgeous, rebound in a dark navy blue cover with a bunch of original fan art inside the book. We can't thank the Rolling Library enough for this gift. Whoever wins this is very lucky because there were only 10 copies of this made.
That's very rare.
Yes. And it's super nice. So we have one giveaway, two different winners. One person will win the official Cuckoo's Calling and another person will win the Rolling Library edition. So how to enter? We're keeping this pretty simple. Send us an email at sefilespodcast@gmail.com with the subject line TSEF100, that's TSEF100, and tell us your favorite moment from the podcast.
Yeah.
We're doing it this way because we really want to thank the listeners for your support these last few years, and we thought that this would be the best way to ensure that the books go to listeners.
Yeah.
So again, email sefilespodcast@gmail.com. Make sure you put TSEF100 in the subject line, and that will make it easier for us to see all the entries. And as of right now, there should also be a blog post on our website explaining all of this, and it will also have some pictures that I took of my copies of these books so that you can see what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
When we record episode 25, we will use one of those websites that picks a random winner, and we'll do that as we record so everyone can hear. We'll probably pick a winner for the official Cuckoo's Calling first, and then we'll do the Rolling Library one, and we'll email the winners and let them know.
Mm-hmm.
You have until March 15th to enter.
Mm-hmm.
All entries need to be submitted by March 15th.
11:59 p.m.
There you go.
Pacific time.
So yeah, we hope that everyone is as excited about this as we are, and just thank you for listening. Pools, do you have any disclaimer stuff to add?
Yes, I think you covered pretty much all of it, but I will just say that the full terms and conditions of the contest are in the blog post on our website. We'll link to it in the show notes so that you know exactly how to enter and what the sort of guidelines for the contest are. It's open to all of our listeners, and our website is thesefilespod.com, and the post will be on the blog section.
Yes.
I'm excited. This is fun.
I have the book sitting right here next to me.
Do you? Oh, nice.
I do. Okay. Should we get to our listener question?
Yes, we should.
Technically, this is not a listener question because we realize that most of the ones we have left are either better suited to chapter discussions or they're about the ending. There's a lot about the ending and we're saving them. So if you have any fun ideas of things that we can do in the beginning of these episodes, please let us know.
Mm-hmm.
I came up with this question mostly because we just all really like heist movies.
Yes,
we do. I thought it would be fun if each of us planned a different heist, but we got to pick four characters to help us pull it off.
Yes.
Not including Strike and Robin, because obviously they'd be all of our first choices.
Right. Mm-hmm. Got to keep it interesting.
So we're going to say what kind of heist we're doing.
Yeah.
And what four characters we picked and why.
Yes.
And by the way, these picks can be characters who are good or bad, alive, dead, anything goes except for Strike and Robin.
I'm so excited.
Okay, can I go first?
Yeah, go first. I want to hear your heist.
So I want to do a jewelry heist.
Are you breaking into Madeline's jewelry store or like a different?
I'm imagining that this is some $1 billion jeweled necklace that we're swapping out with a fake.
Yeah.
And I'm imagining that this goes down at some big event where the necklace is the highlight of the evening. It's a big event.
So like Ocean's 11, the one with the women?
Is that what they do?
I didn't watch the whole thing. I got bored. I think there was a necklace involved.
Okay. Well, we're swapping out a necklace. Sure.
Yeah, gotcha.
So it's funny that you mentioned Madeline because the first person I would want on my heist team is Madeline Corson Miles.
Of course.
She's the perfect person for a jewelry heist because she's a jewelry designer.
Yep.
Not only is she the reason we're getting an invite to this event,
yes,
But she's also talented enough to create the fake that we need to swap out with the real thing.
Smart.
And let's face it, she's also the right amount of crazy to probably agree anyway.
She's fucking nuts.
So, absolutely. There we go.
Beautiful. Great.
Heister number two. I want Vanessa. I want someone with law enforcement insider information. Okay. Vanessa's going to find out what kind of security police force there will be, help figure out how to get by it all, right?
Oh, yeah.
Plus, her wanting Robin to make a necklace out of Sarah Shadlock's earring says to me that she's down for jewelry-related mischief.
Hijinks.
Right?
Right, yeah.
Right.
That makes sense.
Mischief.
Jewelry-related mischief.
Thank you.
Which the theft of a $1 billion necklace totally counts.
Totally counts as mischief, yeah.
100%. It's a misdemeanor at best.
Heister number three.
Yeah.
I want Morehouse.
Yeah.
We all know that every good heist needs a cyber genius to help us bypass secret lasers and stuff, right? That's what they're for. So he will be there with us. He's just going to be doing it from his own room where he's hacked into the system and he's talking to us through our earpieces.
Yes.
Morehouse is in this for the money. In reality, he's going to use it to escape Annamie's clutches and live happily ever after with his new, beautiful, and sweet girlfriend.
Yeah, who he meets somehow during the heist.
Right. They fall in love.
Spoiler alert, we're on slightly similar wavelengths.
Okay.
Out of our eyes. Continue though.
Okay. I just really want a happy ending for Morehouse.
Dang, girl.
And finally, my last member is Al Rokeby.
Damn, wild card.
He's going to be there, but never interact with us. And he's completely separate from our group. Well, just so, you know, no one notices us together.
Right.
And he's the right social status that it makes sense that he would be there. Yeah. But we also know he has a car, so he's our getaway driver.
In a getaway car.
Yeah. We're going to meet at the motel bar.
Great. Love it.
That's a Taylor Swift quote. Sorry. So at a certain time, he will leave, right? Wait for us to turn up. Mm-hmm. We all drive away. No one knows we're ever working together, right? Amazing. And obviously, I think that I'm the one who has to do the actual swap because everyone else has actual real jobs.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, during the downtime, I'm asking Madeline for details about Strike.
Right.
That's my heist.
Well, that's an amazing heist.
Thank you.
Applause. Beautiful. I think you definitely pull it off.
Thank you.
The necklace is swapped. Your $1 billion richer split five ways.
Yeah, there we go.
Amazing.
It's really easy to plan a heist when it's not real.
It's so easy. Okay, can I go with my heist now?
Yeah, what are you doing?
So my heist is we are recovering a lost masterpiece that was looted by the Nazis in World War II.
Oh my God, you really
Jesus Christ.
Because this is real. The Nazis looted all kinds of fucking art and there are ton of masterpieces that are still missing, like Rembrandt, a Pissarro, a Van Gogh, a Degas, looted.
I love how you make yours justified.
Oh, we haven't even started.
Oh boy.
This masterpiece is, we found out it's in the compound, like a heavily secured compound of like a very bad guy. Maybe one of the descendants of the Nazis in South America, who's now like a really evil drug lord and makes all kinds of money and has the stolen loot. Bad, bad guy. As part of our heist, obviously, we're stealing the masterpiece and returning it to its rightful owners, whether it's a family or whether it belongs in the museum.
She's like Robin Hood.
I don't know. We're Robin Hood. We're Indiana Jones. We're sometimes bad guys make the best good guys, you know? So we're also going to expose this guy's crimes, bring down his empire, send him to jail, completely ruin him, probably make off with a large chunk of his bank account to pay us for our time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, who do you think is going to be my first?
Henry Drummond, because he's an art dealer.
No.
No?
See, I'm going with my roles. I don't have the exact heist planned out, so I need the classic heist roles. So we need a hitter, a hacker, a grifter, a thief, and a mastermind. So since that's five, I'm going to have to be the mastermind.
Oh, naturally.
Yes. So for my hitter, I'm going with Jonah Adjeman.
Okay.
Blast from the past.
He has combat training from the army, right? Basic soldier training. He can handle a gun. He can take a guy down 100%. Mm-hmm. He's also easy on the eyes.
We know that. He's Lula's brother.
Nice to look at. And since he's a sapper, part of the Royal Engineers, I looked this up this afternoon, he also has military engineering training with stuff like explosives, mines, tunnels, construction, demolition.
You do need that. In a heist.
In a heist. Very, very useful skills. He's switching roles. Okay. Obviously for the hacker, it's got to be Morehouse. Because, yes, he's a genius. He's got computer skills.
Right. We're on the same page.
We'll be able to hack the security system. We're going to be able to do any digital thing we need to do for the heist.
Mm-hmm.
And he has all kinds of like science and physics knowledge. It'll suddenly turn out to be helpful as well. And I'm thinking that he and Jonah Adjeman, kind of near the same age, might become friends. So he has a new friend to sort of boost his confidence and be his buddy and help him get out there, right? Because John Ackerman seemed like a real sweetie.
Yeah.
But maybe a bit lonely. He's going to need a friend. They bond.
I just really love how we both want happily ever afters for Morehouse.
We're really invested in giving Morehouse a better ending. We're really invested.
Oh my God, we're going to have to watch Morehouse be killed.
I don't want to do that. I don't want to do that. Okay. So my grifter, Dev, he's played the art dealer before. Mm. Okay. He's got the looks.
He's just picking all these handsome men.
I do. You picked all handsome men. Do you want some eye candy around? Yes. He's got the intelligence. He's a quiet threat. He's a masterful grifter. He's smart. He can learn any skill set. I have confidence in him to grifter our way into this compound.
Yeah,
I really do. And then for the thief, the final role, Midge.
Oh,
mostly because I just want to hang out with her. I think she'd draw Morehouse out of his shell. She'd add a fun dynamic to the team. But also she's got the athleticism, the physical coordination, the initiative. She's an adrenaline junkie. She's like the fun, loose cannon. I can picture Midge backflipping through the laser grids.
I feel like you're describing Abigail.
Well, I thought about Abigail, but I didn't really want to hang out with her, whereas I do want to hang out with Midge.
I guess if we're comparing wanting to hang out between Midge and Abigail, then I would pick Midge.
You would pick Midge? How kind of you.
Yeah,
thank but you. But like, I can picture Midge flip-flopping her back through the laser grids. She's hanging down ropes from ceilings. She's doing all kinds of athletic stuff. Plus, if we get in a jam, she's got her cell phone. She rings up Tasha Mayo, and we've got a backup grifter / money source to bail us out.
There you go.
So that's my heist. That's my dream team. We're doing this.
Jonah, Morehouse, Dev and Midge.
Dev and Midge, yes.
All right.
And me, the mastermind.
And you, right.
Restoring this masterpiece to the museum.
I think you're successful.
Bringing down the drug lord, enriching our bank accounts.
Great. What about you, Kenz?
Admittedly, I don't think that I thought the actual heist situation through as much as I did, like, the people. Mm-hmm. The thing that I had in mind is, you guys have watched season one of UK Traitors, right?
Of course.
Of course.
Have. Okay. So yes. I'm thinking, you know, the bit with the lasers and them. That's what I
have. Oh, yeah. I love that.
We recall the lasers.
That's basically my situation.
You're stealing something.
Something with lasers. Yeah.
Yeah. Something with lasers. That's about as far as I got.
Just say it's like bars of gold or something.
Yeah. There we go.
So my main two people are going to be Barkley and Midge. I feel like they would be nimble and athletic enough to be able to get around the lasers.
Barkley can like joke his way through guards and stuff.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Dig a hole.
He's good at digging.
Now, I had an idea of keeping like a heavy around just in case. And that person's going to be Stephen Ellicott.
Oh, he was on my backups. Yes. Mm-hmm. And I feel like he'd get along with Barkley and Midge too.
And then for the person who's working out like logistics and finding out information, I put Dev for that, because if there's anything that I've learned from video games, it's that if you have a high enough charisma skill, you can charm information out of just about anybody.
100%. That's see how you it works. Play Fallout, etc.
Yes. And then for my driver, I'm going to put Martin Ellicott.
Nice. Well, if you can't have the OG Robin, go for the backup.
Exactly.
You might show up drunk.
You got lots of Ellicotts.
I do.
It's the Ellicott heist. I like it.
Thanks.
I love this question. This is so much fun.
So much fun.
I love a heist.
Tell us who you would want on a heist.
Can we do more questions like that?
We do need some more questions like this for the beginnings of these parts of the episode. So
if anyone has any ideas,
please give us some ideas.
Chapter 59.
In chapter 59, Strike learns that Charlotte has been arrested for assault. And the epigraph for this chapter is, to the thoughtful man, such occurrences are grave omens that he does not neglect. And that is from hexagram 63 after completion.
I think there are quite a few bad omens in this chapter that Strike recognizes. So first, it's the Franks and their kidnapping plot. Strike sees what's happening there. Then there's Charlotte's escalating behavior when she's arrested for assault. And then there's the woman who approaches Strike and almost blows his cover.
Absolutely. And he doesn't neglect any of them.
No, he doesn't.
So we start the chapter with an extra creepy update on the Franks. Mm-hmm. So they bought rope and a van. And then Strike also believes that they're planning on kidnapping Tasha Mayo soon.
Totally ridiculous that the police still aren't doing anything, although I guess it is best how it ends up, because now they can charge them with actual attempted kidnapping. Not that that's helpful. in the real world, because most people wouldn't be able to afford Strike and Robin.
Yeah, these guys probably wouldn't get a minute of jail time for stalking, judging by the past. And it's not like a restraining order would stop them. Sadly, probably best to catch them in the act. And like you said, it's so sad to think of the implications. And these are real world implications too, mm-hmm. for all the millions of women who don't have Tasha Mayo's money. Like, I don't take away from how terrifying it is to be Tasha Mayo and be stalked and almost kidnapped by these guys, but she's got Strike. Lots of many millions of women don't.
I want to go back to our old idea of side cases reflecting the main case, because even Tasha thinks that Strike might be over-exaggerating. She says, God, I thought they were just a bit weird and annoying, not actually dangerous. Yeah. This is exactly what Strike and Robin talk about later with the UHC and people looking the other way or just calling them weird. This is an absolute definite parallel to the main case.
It totally is a parallel. You're right. I was personally shocked that Tasha Mayo had a second of doubt with Strike taking this too seriously. Because, I mean, they bought rope and a hammer in disguises. Does our girl not watch true crime?
I guess it's just that thing of not wanting to believe it.
Yeah.
I'm always ready to believe it.
Oh, I believe it literally every second of every day.
The person knocking at the door, murderer. They're obviously going to kill me. Right.
Yeah. I hear a sound in the ceiling. Murderer.
Right.
Living in the walls. Mm-hmm. Grab the knife.
Right after this, it takes us to their next side case, though, the one with the wealthy mother and her much, much younger male companion. So I'm wondering if there's anything to this one that connects to the main case. This is the client that believes his mother is frittering away his inheritance on a toy boy. Mazu definitely spent her daughter's inheritance, so
it's true.
I guess. Someone explained this to me, though. Wouldn't that just mean that she's spending her own money since she's alive? What am I missing?
But the thing is, it's money that she should be squirreling away so that her son can have it when she dies, which basically means it's already the son's money. So the son should be able to stop her from spending any money because it's basically his money, I guess.
I just don't understand what action he's going to take from the proof of it.
Oh.
What is he going to do with the information?
You know what? You're right. What the hell is he going to do? Like, what's he going to do?
Yeah, I don't know.
Your mom's out to lunch with a 40-year-old. Good for her. She can get it, I guess. Like, not good for her because she might be being taken advantage of.
I feel like I'm missing something. If I'm missing something, somebody explain it to me, please.
Let's read more of this case. And isn't this the one where Amelia at the end of the book says you recently helped a friend of ours with his mother being taken advantage of?
Is that what she meant?
I'm pretty sure that Toy Boy was
a friend of hers. How funny that they don't like this client either. And it's a friend of...
Right?
Yeah.
We're going to have to reread this because I'm not 100%, but I'm pretty sure that this is a friend of hers that they helped out.
That makes sense.
In the general, regarding your question, I think that family members being concerned about relatives sending their money to the UHC is kind of a parallel here, right? Mm-hmm. Plus the elderly woman being taken advantage of by a young, handsome man who's pretending to be in love with her has a very golden prophet waste vibe.
Yeah, it does.
Very much so.
I think it fits. I think our theory on this still holds.
I agree.
There's a lot that goes on in this bit. First, I really like the return of the hidden camera glasses.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think they have just the one pair? Do they have more? Do Strike and Robin share?
You know, given the amount of money that they're bringing in, I bet they at least have like a handful of them now. At least
spoil it, we want them to share the same glasses, which is basically the same as kissing with your eyes.
They do a lot of kissing with their eyes in the show.
They do.
They really do. Also, I bet that Strike thinks Robin looks really cute whenever she wears the surveillance glasses.
Absolutely.
I mean, he thinks she looks cute all the time, let's be real.
You always look great.
Oh.
The other things that are going on. Second, I know that Strike has recently made a vow against risky flings, but as soon as I see anything about an attractive woman smiling at him, I'm nervous.
Oh, yeah. Yep. We're on the same wavelength here because I was instantly on guard.
Right.
Like, hell no.
100%.
Yeah. I was like, what does she want? Stay away from him.
Time to break out the spray bottle. Stay away, lady.
Yes.
Yeah. I had my spray bottle ready to go, but I was so glad that he instantly looked away without smiling and I didn't have to use it.
Joe faked us out a couple times with this in the book. Abigail, now this one.
Mm-hmm.
The one I was sure wasn't going to happen was Bijou. So then it was like,
fucking oops.
It happened. And now every other time I'm like, nope. No, please, God. No, God, no.
Spray him.
No more.
Spray.
We know that this woman isn't great at surveillance, but she did manage to follow him there.
You know what? I'm really curious about this woman and whether she'll show up again, because she was given a name and she shows up like four different times. So she's the one who met with Kevin and recorded that conversation and failed. Yeah. She follows Strike. She planted the bugs in Humboldt's office.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like she also went undercover at Zhao's Bob before the book started. Yeah,
that was her too.
So she's obviously not anywhere near competent enough to be hired to work for Strike and Ellicott after Patterson goes to jail. But maybe she could be like a rival again at some point.
I especially don't think she would work for them after trying to set him up.
No, I don't think that Strike would hire her.
No.
Now that I think about it, I'm shocked that we haven't found out that Morris went to work for Patterson after Troubled Blood. It seems like he'd be Patterson's ideal hire if he wanted dirt on Strike and the agency, right?
Maybe Morris is too afraid to say anything because Strike threatened him.
Yeah, stepped towards him menacingly.
That BDE.
I remember that part.
Yeah, I feel like Morris is going to be lurking out there somewhere. Maybe he'll team up with this woman.
I'm fine with him and his penis being long gone.
Aren't we all?
And then, of course, the other thing that happens is Strike sees the article about Charlotte being arrested for assaulting her boyfriend.
Mm.
I feel like this can't possibly be the first time she's been arrested for assault, can it?
Maybe she's just gotten lucky before now. I don't think Strike would have ever called the cops on her. And we don't actually know for sure about her assaulting anyone else. Although, I mean, Jago probably, but...
Sure, but I don't care about him.
And he also wouldn't call the cops, right?
For
reasons other than Strike's, which is that he probably assaulted her right back.
I mean, I think it's safe to assume that she assaulted other people, but maybe no one else ever pressed charges.
If she mostly saves it for boyfriends, I think she'd have gotten lucky before now.
And it seems like, I don't know, did you guys get the impression that the neighbors were the ones who called the cops? Because it does say that the quote from the witness who heard the screams and breaking glass, it fits very well with what we already know about Charlotte.
Very much so.
I definitely rolled my eyes at Amelia's quote at the end that she's confident Charlotte will be exonerated. Sure, Jen.
Okay.
All right. Strike looks at some of the links in the article, and both of the Charlotte links have a connection to him. There's the one of Charlotte at Madeline's jewelry launch and then her stay at Simmons' house.
I don't know if it means anything, but this, along with him being mentioned, as he always is in articles about Charlotte, it just gives me the feeling that he still can't escape her. You know, this connection with both of the stories, even though he's done, she really does follow him around like a ghost or something. What's that line in Lethal White that I'm thinking of about her following him?
I think that the one that you're thinking of is the one that goes, as he slammed his way out into the street, he felt as though he was pursued, as though Charlotte had projected after him a succubus that would tail him until they met again.
Yes.
Right after their conversation at Franco's.
Yes. It's like that's what she has been doing this whole time.
Yeah.
There's a photograph of Charlotte at the top and it says, Charlotte's makeup was smeared, her hair tousled, and she faced the camera defiantly as she was led away by the policewoman.
I wish I knew exactly what day this happened and if it coincided with her threatening messages to Strike. Maybe she was really looking for a fight, and when she couldn't get Strike to fight with her, she took it out on Landon.
Yeah, that seems likely.
I would bet cash money on that. Mm-hmm. I feel like we could figure it out if we went like into the timeline.
Maybe. Maybe this. Katie would know.
Let's summon the Strike fans army to figure this out for us.
Do we just like put a swan signal in the sky?
Yes. Oh, we need to set that up. Katie, we need you. Turn on the swan signal. Yeah. Ooh, I love it. She's got a little phone that she picks up. Oh, that's great. I'm on board with this. We got to get it sorted. Uh-huh.
Whenever there's new Strike news, swan in the sky.
Oh my God.
Oh, I love that.
Amazing.
While she'd generally done most damage to herself when angry or distressed, Strike still bore a small scar over his eyebrow from the ashtray Charlotte had thrown at him as he walked out of her flat for the last time. She'd launched herself at him many times during rows, attempting to either claw his face or punch him. But this had been far easier to deal with than flying missiles, given that he was considerably larger than her, and, as an ex-boxer, good at parrying attacks. Nevertheless, at least four of their breakups had come in the aftermath of her attempting to physically hurt him. He remembered the sobs afterwards, the desperate apologies, the vows to never do it again. Vows she sometimes kept for as much as a year.
This makes me sad for him. I wonder what his thoughts are about this, because we don't actually know. He's just thinking about the facts of what happened, but I want to know how he sees it now, how he feels about the fact that he stayed, that he was in an abusive relationship. I wonder if we'll ever hear him think about that, or given that he acknowledges that he was so much bigger, maybe he doesn't really feel traumatized by it at all.
He was never in fear for his life.
Doesn't mean it wasn't abusive, though.
Still unacceptable behavior, obviously.
You know, it would be really nice for him to call it what it is. Mm. Use the word, I was in an abusive relationship, because it's what it was. Regardless of whether he feared for his life, it was still abusive.
Yes.
This last sentence here, it really is telling without ever having to actually use the word, because the way that it's described, her assaulting him, her crying and apologizing and saying it's never going to happen again, only for it to then happen again. I mean, we all have heard that before. We know what that is. But yeah, it would be nice to see him recognize that a little bit more explicitly. But I think that that's what it's trying to accomplish here. But I think it's funny, though, also that you brought up that bit from Strike and Charlotte's conversation in Franco's from Lethal White earlier, Lindsay, because there's a part a couple of chapters later in chapter 52 that I'm sure you remember that reminds me of this, when he thinks about how the girlfriends and wives of his friends would say, that's not love what she does to you. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was our first real hint at that, right?
Yeah, I imagine Ilsa said that as well.
Oh, 100% yeah. Ilsa said that. But our first real hint, apart from him literally having a black eye and cuts to his face when we first meet him.
That's true. That's very true.
That makes me sad.
He wants something different.
Okay.
Oh.
Okay.
Moving on.
Roll out the emotions closet.
Yep.
Babe, I've been in there all day. I know.
All right, so the chapter ends where the good-looking woman approaches him to ask if he's Cormor and Strike and almost ruins his surveillance.
I was no longer worried about this woman in a romantic sense. That was a very fleeting worry. Mm-hmm. But now I was worried about what this actually is.
Right, because her demeanor comes off as way too purposeful to be someone who just innocently recognized him, right?
Yeah.
I was picking up like a smug, smirking vibe to her that was super sus.
And by the way, also during this chapter, he does get a call from Leonard Heaton to set up an interview. Mm. And he's just as annoying over the phone as he is in person. So there's also that.
Wonderful.
Can't wait to hear more of his awful jokes.
Let's go to chapter 60.
All right. So in chapter 60, Robin is intercepted by Lynn while she's writing a letter to Strike.
Ooh, and the epigraph, six in the third place means contemplation of my life decides the choice between advance and retreat. And that's hexagram 20, contemplation view. I think this is very clearly Robin making a choice whether to stay or not after Lynn catches her in the forest.
Yeah.
I was just about to say that I wish she had left, but then I'm thinking, do I really want it? Like, not really, because then we wouldn't get the you-know-what chapters.
Yes. Well, part of us wishes that Robin could just escape. The story and the emotional catharsis that we're waiting for, they need her to stay. But she is giving it serious thought in this chapter. She is thinking, contemplating. Also, there's a neat little Easter egg in this hexagram, I think. So hexagram 20 is described as the following. A slight variation of tonal stress gives the Chinese name for this hexagram a double meaning. It means both contemplating and being seen. In the hexagram, it's like in the sense of being an example for people. But it's funny to me that this is when Robin is literally seen while contemplating.
Right.
Little funny joke.
I remember my reaction to the opening of this chapter the first time I read it, because it says that Robin went to the rock on Friday and it was an immediate, what happened to Thursday? What happened?
Yeah.
And then when she gets to the rock, she's found that there are two Yorkie bars. And I have to say, I love every instance of him giving her chocolate while she's in here.
Me too.
Yeah. You gotta love that it always mentions the chocolate.
Again, I don't really know what these chocolate bars are. It's not like a York peppermint patty, is it?
Because
it's not my favorite.
I'd be so mad.
Yeah. So,
from what I can tell, it looks like it's a chocolate bar that's got kind of like chunky blocks with divots in between each section, kind of like a Toblerone bar.
Okay.
If you're familiar.
I mean, I'm familiar from Friends, but yeah.
Fun fact, these Yorkie bars were originally made by Roundtree's, which is, as we know, the chocolate company that Robin's family dog was named after. But so I went to read about this chocolate bar, and it is ridiculous because apparently the Yorkie was designed as a chocolate bar to be marketed to men specifically. It was supposed to be a manly chocolate bar.
Manly chocolate bar.
What is a manly chocolate bar? I don't know. They leaned into that sexist marketing in the 2000s. They had really grown sexist ads and they had promotions where they gave away chocolate bars to only men, which is insane to me. The slogan was literally, it's not for girls.
Oh, okay.
And I'm like, that just seems like such a stupid way to market chocolate.
Yeah, like, it does.
All of this is leading somewhere, because I do actually appreciate one of the old slogans for this chocolate bar, which was, welcome to York, where the men are hunky and the chocolate's chunky. I'm like, oh, the men are hunky indeed, Strike. Are you sending Robin a message with this?
You know what? It might be worth it just for that slogan. I just like that. Just
for that slogan? Mm-hmm. Yes, it is.
That's funny.
Anyway, two chocolates and then three letters. There's one from Strike, one from Murphy, and one from Dev. And the first letter that we hear about is Murphy's, and it says, Ryan's was essentially a thinly veiled request to know when she'd be leaving Chapman Farm.
Do we have any thoughts about this?
Of course.
That's a joke. Of course we do.
Yeah, I'm expressing my thoughts through very creative hand gestures.
I see.
Sit and spin on this, Murphy.
Actually, don't. That's gross.
Ew, yeah. No, don't. Just metaphorically.
Right. I really wish we could have seen exactly what it said so I could decide how bad it is or isn't.
Exactly. Like, come on, Joe. I've got my red pen out. I'm ready to go to town.
We're ready.
You know, okay, one thing I can't fault Murphy for is struggling with her being undercover for so long in a dangerous situation.
Mm.
I think I could see myself begging to know when she'd leave too. It might speak to uncommunicated expectations they have in this relationship.
Yeah.
I guess I just don't blame him for feeling this way. I'm just annoyed by how he expresses it.
Get out of here with your reasonableness, you Murphy apologist.
Oh no.
Now I'm joking. I guess that I too would not be thrilled if someone I was dating for a year went undercover for like 2.5 months at this point. But hey, good news. She's more than halfway through.
I feel like there's something on the tip of my tongue about how he expresses himself in these letters versus that I love you that's coming up that I absolutely hate deep in my soul.
Same girl.
I think it's because I don't feel any love in these letters.
No.
I feel love in Strike's letters. He's always wanting to know if she's okay, asking if she wants to leave, reminding her that he'll come for her. Murphy's letters lack any and all feeling. And if this is when he realizes that he loves her, how is there no feeling in your letters?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Just from Robin's description of its contents, I don't get, like you said, any concern for her in Murphy's letter. Just concerned about when his plans for and with her can get back on track.
Exactly.
If that makes sense. I'm thinking specifically about this vacation to his sister's that's coming up quick now. He's like, when are you leaving? I gotta book the plane tickets. Let's
exactly.
go.
It's totally possible that we'll read more in book 8 and maybe this is unfair, but I don't know whether or not I believe that he truly loves her.
Yeah.
Not that it matters whether he does or doesn't. He's getting dumped anyway.
You dumped. Yep.
Let's just kick him right off that cliff that's in Joe's new header.
Oh,
yeah. Hey. Full of great ideas tonight.
He had it coming.
He only had himself to blame. I mean, if you'd have been there, if you'd have seen it, you would have done the same.
Yeah.
We all know that we all would have done the same.
Anyway, we don't get to see Strike's note either. We just hear that he's updating her on the case and what's going on his end. And then we get to read the note from Dev. And it says, I checked the rock last night and I'm still in the vicinity. Strike says if there's nothing by midnight tomorrow, he's driving up and he'll come in the front on Sunday. For God's sake, Strike, muttered Robin.
I love him. I love him. I love this whole part.
Yeah.
I kind of hope there was a bit of laughter in that, for God's sake, because this would freak me out if I was on the outside too.
Mm-hmm.
This is the first time this happens, and I can imagine how it must have felt for Dev and Strike for there not to be a note. It must have been really scary.
I'm frankly amazed that Strike didn't immediately drive up so as to be in place just in case something had happened and she didn't show up again, right? I feel like maybe he was on the verge of doing that and Dev talked him down, saying that he can sneak in and rescue her if he has to or something.
Even if that wasn't what happened, you know Strike was very anxious about this.
So anxious, especially given he later thinks, thank God it was an illness or injury or something.
Yeah, he was worried. Also, come on, Robin. We all love Strike wanting to come get you. Don't pretend like there isn't a part of you that loves that he cares so much.
Yeah. Right.
You know, part of me wonders what she's going to think about things like this now that she knows that he's in love with her.
Oh, no.
God, yeah. I don't know why, but I like that she starts the letter with, hi, Cormoran.
Yeah, I'd missed hearing her call Strike by his first name.
So have I. The Strike nickname is really cute and everything, but I love the name Cormoran, and I love that she was the only one to ever use it fully and not just Corm.
I'd like to see her call him that, though, too, at some point.
To see her call him Corm?
Yeah.
She does one time, but I don't know if it's because she cut herself off or if she meant to. It's incredible.
My imagination is that it was cut off, because I know the exact one.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yes, in the interview with Tempest.
Yes, because it's bothered me as well. I feel like it was because she was cut off.
I think so, too.
That's my headcanon.
But she does still call him Cormoran. It's just mixed in with Strike. I did go double check this, because it does happen throughout The Running Grave.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think this significance of her calling him Qormoran was kind of more in our minds before Troubled Blood than yeah. it ended up being, since the true intimacy with names started with her saying strike.
And how much he liked it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think we were a little backwards on that, but I just liked her writing it out. I think it's because it felt like a very friendly hello to show that she's okay.
Yeah.
Okay, the first thing that she tells Strike about is the argument between Becca and Emily.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything here that we don't already know, right?
No, just recaps. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then the next thing is about the stolen prophet's manifestation, which is really creepy.
It is. I'm kind of glad we didn't have to read about this happening in real time, because from what Robin says, it seems like she found it scary and horrible. Mm. I'm sure it would have been tough to read if she was feeling that way.
See, mm-hmm. that was the exact reason that I wish we'd been able to read about it, because it would have been so scary and good.
Oh boy.
But, you know, in a book this long, there's going to have yeah. to be stuff that's summarized. And the manifestation and Wang giving birth aren't directly connected to the Dayu mystery the way that Beck and Emily's conversation was. So it makes right. sense.
So when Robin talks about the giant wire and straw figure that was supposed to be the stolen prophet coming to life, she tells Strike that she's not sure how they made it move because it was just wire and straw. Mm-hmm. I Googled this and I found something that I think it could be. Hmm. If there was a base for the figure, they could have used something called a cranky contraption. Kind of sounds like something Strike gets stuck in. Are you in a cranky contraption?
That's his nickname for the BMW. Yeah,
it connects to the wire and basically looks like how you used to roll down a car window, you know?
Yeah.
So it's just a lever that someone would turn in this box and move mm-hmm. the wire up and down.
I was just going to say, you know, wires, knit, and just leave it at that.
We don't know if there is a base, and I'm not sure how they would have then got the noose to lift it up. But unless there's someone in the base, like, cutting the wires at the right time.
I figured there'd be wires coming down from the galleries in the ceiling, like in plays where the actors fly, right? Or marionettes. It made sense to me that they'd be able to move it up with, like, a pulley with the noose itself and make it dance around, right?
I just think that wires hanging down are so visible. And Robin said she had no idea how it was done. And I think that she would have been looking for that.
Maybe they paint them with invisible ink.
Or that. Or that, yeah.
Your explanation is more thought out than mine. I'm just like, it's fucking wires, whatever. I mean, I feel like the invisible ink would work.
I bet they just used Wingardium Leviosa.
That checks out. That makes a lot more sense.
So the description of the bit with the noose is really awful, though, where it says, the thick rope snaking down out of the darkness, the noose falling around the figure's neck, then tightening, and the rope lifted the figure into the air, and it started thrashing around and screaming and trying to chant. Then went limp.
This is 100% done with the intention to scare these people from ever leaving. You know, look what will happen to you if you leave.
Yeah, Robin's absolutely right. This sounds terrifying.
I so hope that we get to see this in a show, because it'd be so scary.
Oh my God.
I'd love it.
It's so funny because now that they're filming Ink Black Heart, I keep thinking about parts I can't believe we'll get to see, even though I've always known that we would. Mm-hmm. But it's going to happen with The Running Grave too. We're going to get to see the shared bed. We're going to see him tell her that he's in love with her.
Stop. I can't handle that. No, can't do that tonight.
Anyway, that's off topic.
Okay, so the next thing that she writes about is Wan giving birth.
Oh, this is awful and sad.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Leather strapped to bite on, rusty forceps, and the fact that she's not supposed to make a sound.
How the hell is she supposed to do that?
No, this is 10,000 times more terrifying than the manifestation. Rusty tools in my vagina? No, thank you. No.
Amen.
But I'm also betting that there was absolutely no proper sanitation of anything going on here. Tools, hands, nothing.
It's really weird that they wouldn't do that kind of stuff if they want people alive to make babies.
If they want babies to sell, they should have safe delivery for the babies. What the
fuck? This is just laziness. The worst part for me was when it said that Wan didn't even look at her baby. I think this has to be because it would have been too painful if she was just going to be taken away from her anyway.
I think you're absolutely right. She's trying to protect herself by not getting attached, which is basically impossible. She already knows she's not going to be allowed to keep the baby, so she's disconnecting.
Yeah.
There's another interpretation here that could be the brainwashing about flesh objects, materialism, forcing this, like Shauna's detachment from her kids. Yeah. But honestly, the first reading feels more true to me for Wan.
I think so, especially because we know she was reunited with this baby.
Yeah.
Feels like a happy ending there, at least.
Robin starts writing to Strike about Sita when she realizes that someone else is there, and then she sees Lynn carrying plants.
Oh, okay. So I have to imagine at this point, Lynn has realized she's pregnant, probably by Giles Harmon, since we saw them leaving the retreat rooms. Ugh. And she wants to end the pregnancy. Because we already saw her freaking out about this happening. She didn't want this to happen.
And now it has. Are there any plants growing here that we could pick and put in Harmon's soup to cause him some severe pain and suffering? Just curious. Sure.
Maybe severe itching. That would be pretty good.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was thinking more like blood spewing from every orifice until he collapses in death. But I guess an itchy whatever works too.
Or maybe a very irritable bowel.
Sure. You guys are not thinking big enough here, but we'll start small.
Okay, Janice.
I mean, in this case, yeah, I'm prepared to accept that.
But by the way, speaking of Janice, could we count this as a troubled blood connection? Pregnant by an abusive man and ending the pregnancy.
Oh, yeah.
Like Gloria.
She doesn't have a Margot, though.
I think that you're definitely onto something there. Though it does make me wonder who told her what plants to look for, or if maybe this is some sort of arcane knowledge that sort of passed around amongst the women at the UHC for when you really don't want to be pregnant.
Yeah, I didn't really think about that, but I could totally see this being passed down like that. You'd think the UHC would have removed it if it was happening a lot, but maybe one of the older women told her, like Sita. Maybe Sita was her Margot.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
or someone.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, this absolutely feels like women's knowledge to me. In the past, this was exactly how it worked. Women taught girls and younger women about what they needed to do to end pregnancies, and that knowledge was passed down over the centuries. My point is that no totalitarian system of control or brainwashing ever works 100% of the time for 100% of the people, right? There are always going to be little pockets of defiance or resistance or ignoring the rules or justifying moving around the rules. And this knowledge, it has to be part of that sort of slipping under the radar here.
I was mostly confident that this was going to be okay. As much as I wanted Robin to leave, I knew that she probably wasn't going to, but I didn't think that Lynn would tell since she was so afraid of Robin telling on her.
I mean, it's mutually assured destruction, basically, right? This was never going to be the thing that got Robin caught.
But this is the moment where the epigraph comes into play and Robin has to make the decision to stay or go.
She returns to her letter and finishes writing the bit about Sita.
She's been there since the earliest days, it says. Can you imagine spending almost your whole life like this?
Oh, that sounds miserable.
She definitely would know about the plants, though.
So then Robin writes, when I mentioned Becca knowing the drowned prophet, she told me Becca was really jealous of Dayu when they were kids. She said all the little girls love Cherie, and Becca was really envious of Dayu getting special attention from her.
This is interesting because it's another instance of jealousy over a sort of parental figure's attention.
Yep. And this info is part of what helps clue strike in on the Becca is the source of the drowned prophet legend, part of the murder, right?
Yeah.
Robin doesn't know how useful this little piece of information is now, but it does actually turn out to be pretty crucial in the end.
Mm-hmm. I said before that I was mostly confident that Lynn wouldn't tell on Robin, but reading her sitting here and contemplating telling Strike, it made me more nervous because it just felt like it was setting something up. It's just that she has so many of these moments that could have gone really, really badly, and she just lucked out that they didn't.
Yeah, she really, really does luck out. Her thought here in a minute where she's thinking about what Strike would say about her being compromised and not being able to trust a brainwashed teenager had me so, so nervous this was going to go sideways because of her.
Me too. Especially because the Strike in her head was right about this. I guess it's just down to instinct. I don't think that Robin has always been right about her gut feelings, but I think she's counting on the same thing I was counting on, which was that Lynn didn't want to be in trouble either. I mean, now I'm thinking of Robin and risk-taking. She was so much more level-headed in this book as compared to Inkblot Heart, but I think we do see this little risky side of her, right? She's pushing the limits when it comes to staying. And obviously, this was worth it in the end. The risks pay off, but it doesn't mean it wasn't scary to read.
Yeah, it was scary. The difference here is that she is now thinking very carefully and seriously about whether or not she should push it, right? She's weighing the risks and benefits in her head. And yes, she decides on the risky path because she is committed. But this time, she's not just diving in face first. She's doing a much more careful contemplation of the risks in this book, I think.
So we have to end this chapter pointing out that it says, however, after a further minute's deliberation, she signed the letter without mentioning Lynn, took up a fresh piece of paper, and turned instead to the task of explaining to Murphy why she still wasn't ready to leave Chapman Farm.
The task. He is a task.
This feels very Matthew-esque to me.
It's just such a deliberate choice to use that word there. He's a total afterthought, a task. I mean, a task. It's a task. Yeah,
an obligation even, something she feels she has to do but gets no enjoyment out of.
Mm.
I can tell you something, that writing to strike would never feel like a task.
Yeah, Anna Chiara also said the word obligation to me once about this, and I remember thinking, oh, you don't want to be the obligation.
That hurts.
Mm-mm. No.
Oh well, I'm over it.
His days are numbered.
Sorry, Murphy, not really. I won't miss you.
Bye, you showed as he falls off the cliff.
Chapter 61.
All right. In chapter 61, Strike thinks about why he was intercepted during surveillance and receives some more threatening voicemails from Charlotte.
And the epigraph reads, "Nine in the third place. All day long, the superior man is creatively active. At nightfall, his mind is still beset with cares. From Hexagram 1, the creative."
You know, Strike still needs a hug.
Mm.
I am still willing to offer my services.
You're so selfless.
Thank you. He has so many worries right now and problems. It kind of reminds me of that line in Troubled Blood where he thinks about how troubles come all at once.
Yeah, yeah. It's that one towards the end of chapter 42 after Charlotte texts him on Valentine's Day. And it says, "Then he closed his eyes and, like millions of his fellow humans, wondered why troubles could never come singly, but in avalanches, so that you became increasingly destabilized with every blow that hit you."
And Robin was the carabiner. I remember this. We talked about
hiking
this.
Equipment. Yes.
Robin's the hiking equipment. But going back to this hexagram, I thought that you might like this line from the hexagram as symbolic of a certain detective. "The first hexagram is made up of six unbroken lines. These unbroken lines stand for the primal power, which is light-giving, active, strong, and of the spirit. The hexagram is consistently strong in character, and since it is without weakness, its essence is power or energy." Just felt very Strike. And I know I've talked about how Robin's the creative and Strike the receptive, but, you know, they switch places back and forth. Strike does have the creative
primal power.
He has a lot of primal power. Yeah.
All right. So the chapter opens with Strike reflecting on Robin's letter.
The first thing we see him think about is how he had no doubt that the manifestation had been disconcerting for those present, but he agreed with Abigail that these are all tricks. It's not that Strike isn't right, but I think we're seeing clear signs that he just cannot understand how frightening things are unless he's inside. And it's not that I think he's dismissing Robin, saying it was scary, but he's able to look at it very logically because he's so removed from it. I think this actually creates a really good balance between Strike and Robin post-escape, because Robin has all the empathy and understanding when dealing with former members, while Strike is able to maintain that level of objectivity that Robin can't sometimes. I'm thinking of like when he goes to see Wace and how scared she was about it.
Yeah.
It feels like another example of how well they work together and the balance that they have. But this was created by Robin going in. It feels essential to them cracking the case that one of them was in and one of them was out.
Right. Mm-hmm. And then at the same time, it's that same separation that makes their professional relationship stronger. It also draws them together personally as well, because absence makes the heart grow fonder. It's like a rite of passage that both sides of their relationship have to go through.
The next thing that he thinks about is Juan giving birth, and it says, "Robin's account of Juan's labor, on the other hand, genuinely troubled him. He'd been concentrating so hard on deaths at Chapman Farm, with particular focus on proper record keeping, that he'd overlooked possible wrongdoing with regard to births. Now he wondered what would have happened if the mother or baby had died, why Mazu, a woman with no medical background, had to see the baby the moment it was born, and why the baby hadn't been seen since."
This is a huge neon sign pointing us at baby trafficking. And I'm like Dwight driving into the lake and ignoring what's right in front of me, you know?
That is Dwight's slander, because it was Michael
okay.
who drove into the lake because the robot lady told him to. Dwight was the one screaming, "There's a lake there."
Okay.
I can't stand for this.
Yes. Okay. No. That does sound more like Michael. I'm sorry, Dwight.
Right.
Sorry, fictional Dwight.
Mm-hmm.
When he thinks about Becca, I get the feeling that the Becca red herring is starting to come into play here.
I had some big suspicions about Becca when I was first reading this. Totally fell for it.
There were so many things about Becca that I didn't.
So suspicious.
Yeah. It also says that Strike gets the impression that Becca's a bit corporate. No offense to anyone in a corporate position. I didn't take this as a good thing. Maybe a bit cold, calculating.
Yeah.
Yep.
Full offense to any CEOs here. I instantly assumed that this meant psychopath.
Right. And accountants.
Yes. Those two.
And then, of course, Strike considers that Becca has been jealous of the attention Dayu got from Cherie. Mm-hmm. This is the correct motive, but on the wrong person. But it is interesting to me that he just thought the name of the correct person, Abigail, in his thoughts just a few paragraphs ago. Probably not intended to be a clue, but...
Au contraire, mon ami. I am certain that this was definitely intended to be, if not a clue, then one of those deliberate we facepalm when we reread moments.
Another thing that is worrying Strike is the woman who approached him at the restaurant. Obviously, we now know that this is a Patterson spy, but I was worried about this. There weren't many explanations that seemed good.
Yeah. None of this is a good sign.
No.
Speaking of this bit, am I wrong to assume that the various other personal preoccupations that Strike has at this moment definitely include thinking about how in love with his partner he is and how much he misses her? I feel like that's like 80% of his personal
preoccupations. I wish we could have heard it. Yeah.
That and Ted pretty much are the forefront. Yeah, Ted.
I did enjoy that Strike Googled himself for the first time, though. Entertaining.
I'm amazed that he'd never done this before, if only for informational purposes, so he's up to date. But we know that Robin Googles him enough for the both of them.
I wish I could Google him and see the results that he sees. God. I want to see the younger Strike in the army days. I want to see the full beard going into court.
Yeah,
well, there goes the fan art request for this episode.
Yes, please.
All right, so let's go over the three possibilities that Strike considers to explain who this woman is.
Yeah, number one is my favorite thing because it's hilarious.
It
is. The idea of this is so funny to me.
It is hilarious. So it says, first, he'd managed to acquire a stalker. He thought this highly unlikely.
He's never met us.
Right. While he had plenty of supporting evidence to prove he was attractive to certain kinds of women.
Again.
Exactly.
Badly wired lips.
All of us. And his investigative career had taught him that even apparently successful and wealthy people could be harboring strange impulses.
Well, I'm not successful or wealthy, but I have a lot of strange impulses. So does that prove the point? I don't know.
Strike found it very hard to imagine a woman that good looking and well dressed would be following him around for kicks.
So fucking funny. Oh my God.
I would pay so much money to read about Strike telling Robin this exact thought. Or at least whatever it would come out as.
Yes.
It would be so funny. Just imagine him being like, well, maybe I have a stalker. It just reminds me of when she teased him so long ago about the letters from people who found him attractive. And she says, now these are nutty.
Oh my God.
Oh my God. The amount of incredible teasing and bantering we could have gotten with this. So I would gladly pool money together with you to make this happen. You hear that, Joe? Make it happen.
Do you think that she could actually tease him with a straight face now that she's feeling electric shocks when she touches his hair, etc.? Now that she finds him.
But now it would be flirty.
Now it would be super flirty. Yes. Mm-hmm. Oh my God, you're right. All right. Second possibility, because we can't linger on stalker. We're going to be here all night.
Right. Exactly. Second, she has something to do with the Universal Humanitarian Church.
Oh, fuck those guys.
This is exactly what I was most worried about. I had been afraid since we found out that Rupert Court was so close to the office. I thought that they were going to know and figure Strike out and follow him.
Oh, yeah. The thought of which is terrifying because he's already been stabbed within recent memory. We don't need anything else bad happening to him.
No, thank you.
And he has less padding to protect him now.
And then the last thing he considers and the one that he thinks is the most likely is that she's from Patterson.
Yes. Strike thinking this was the most likely did make me feel better because obviously he's right.
Yeah. The instant he said this, it clicked for me because of course it's someone from Patterson. It's the only option that makes sense with the deliberately fucking with his surveillance aspect. I think that at this point, I was just grinning ear to ear, imagining the storm that Corman was going to rain down on Patterson for this.
I really wish I had been a stalker obsessed with him just for fun, for my own entertainment. Not really, but it's hilarious. It is so funny to me that he thinks this.
It is funny. Fingers crossed for book 8. As long as the stalker doesn't turn into like an Annie Wilkes kind of situation, because that would not be fun.
Honestly, I just want to see Robin teasing him about women finding him attractive again.
We all want that.
There's a brief mention that this was the day of the Brexit referendum.
Mm.
Interesting that neither Strike or Robin gets a vote. This is a little parallel with both of them, right? I mean, obviously Robin doesn't get to vote.
Oh, yeah. Connection. Invisible strings. Neither of them
voting. Get to vote,
so it's their fault that Britain leaves the EU, I guess. God damn it. Those were the two votes we needed.
Yep.
Okay, so now it's 11 at night and the voicemails from Charlotte start coming in. Mm-hmm. This is the night, isn't it? She's about to.
Yeah. I guess a moment of solemnity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, nice moment.
Moving on.
We get to hear the start of her last three messages to Strike.
God, her last three messages to anyone, right? I mean, that we know of.
Apart from the letter.
Yeah. I guess we don't know what she did first.
Maybe she wrote it after in a rage that Strike wouldn't pick up. In my head, that's what happened.
Yeah. So the first messages feel like she's appealing to what they used to be. She's calling him Bluey and saying that she needs him.
Yeah.
The second one, she starts putting it on him, saying that he'll answer if he has any humanity.
Guilt trip.
Yeah, and then the last one, she's all the way angry and scary and bringing up Robin again.
Yeah.
The fact that Robin is like her last thought, I feel like she knows where his heart is.
After so many books of Charlotte hanging in Robin's head, like a portrait, now Robin's up living rent-free in Charlotte's
head. You know what? I bet you that Robin's been living in Charlotte's head for a long time, too.
100% she has. Wow. Definitely.
She understands where Strike's heart is, and it's killing her. Oh, literally.
Yeah. Oof.
Oh, yeah.
Ouch.
I have to say, it's eerie to think that this is her last night alive and these are the last things that we ever hear her say.
I know. God, yeah. It's so strange because, of course, we don't like her, but it's still sad.
She was clearly very intelligent.
Funny.
She was apparently funny.
Apparently.
She could have been something really special if she'd been able to get the help she needed and accepted and helped herself, right?
She would have made such a lovely bride.
What a shame she's fucked in the head.
She's fucked in the head, right?
Thank you for finishing that. I think of her every time I hear that line. How could I not?
Yeah, she's Charlotte was very champagne problems.
Okay, this next bit that I'm about to read is, God, it is one of my favorite parts. Though I feel like I say that about so many of these.
I know, it's fine. How could we ever pick?
He knew why Charlotte was taking things this far. She'd at long last admitted to herself that Strike wasn't ever coming back. For nearly 6 years, she'd believed the craving she couldn't eradicate in herself lived on in him too, and that her beauty, her vulnerability, and their long shared history would reunite them no matter all that had gone before, no matter how determined he was not to return. Charlotte's flashes of insight and extraordinary ability to sniff out weak spots had always had something of the witch about them. She'd correctly intuited that he must be in love with his business partner, and this certainty was driving her to new heights of vindictiveness.
I know this is serious and sad, but anytime he thinks about being in love, I'm an instant puddle. Just melted.
Same girl. My God. Same. This is right up there with him casually mentioning to Amelia at the end the whole that I've fallen in love with Robin because
I know
thing.
I know he doesn't say it wasn't true. He was talking about it like it's true.
Exactly. Casually killing me is what it's doing.
Yeah. Yeah.
The casual murder via love confession.
I hope he says it again to someone else in 8.
Yes, to Ilsa, please. Mm-hmm. Or to Nick, which basically means to Ilsa.
Right, same thing.
It would work with Ink Black Heart parallels. Yeah.
Lucy or Prue, literally anyone.
Yeah, I want him to say it out loud to somebody else because it almost makes it so that he can't sink back into himself. Do you know what I mean? It would tie the truth to somebody else. Does that make sense?
Makes it real.
He puts it out not only to Robin, but to the world.
In his friend circle. Yeah, so somebody knows, so he can't just pretend it's not real anymore. There is a small part of me that was curious about what would have happened if Charlotte had lived and if she'd gone to Robin to try and scare her away from him. I don't know if I was ever too into the Charlotte-Robin showdown idea. I'm just very glad that Robin doesn't have to deal with this ever.
Yeah, me too. I think I was into the idea of a showdown between these two in the past, but the way that this ended is perfect because Robin doesn't need to be subjected to any more of Charlotte's poison.
This is where Strike wishes that he hadn't messed with Murphy as much about what Wardle had said to him, because now he's worried that Charlotte will go talking to Murphy about how terrible Strike is. I could totally see Charlotte doing that.
Oh, absolutely she would have. Possibly with a side of a seduction attempt on Murphy to try and, you know, cause Robin pain, worm her way into Robin's life via poison pillow talk with Murphy.
And I don't want this to sound wrong, but I almost feel like this just had to happen for Strike and Robin to be totally free of her. I hadn't always thought this, but now that it's happened, I do feel relieved. I can't imagine Robin falling for any of it or believing it, but it would have caused her so much stress and pain.
Robin knows Strike far too well to believe anything bad that Charlotte would have had to say about him. But Robin would have been super vulnerable to the, he'll never love you like he loves me. We're special. I'm the one he'll always want attack.
Yeah.
That's critical damage on her. So
yeah, I'm glad she doesn't have to ever hear that because it's not true.
It's not true.
I can't wait to hear him think about how that isn't true.
I can't wait to hear him tell Robin about how that's not true.
Oh boy. Okay.
Lord in heaven.
Yeah.
Okay.
How are we going to survive three more books of this kind of emotions?
Spoiler alert. We're not.
After what might have been 1 minute or 10, Strike became aware that he was still standing beside Pat's desk, every muscle in his arms and neck tense. The office looked strange, almost alien in the overhead lights, with the darkness closing in against the windows. As he headed to the door with both partners' names engraved upon it, the only cold comfort he could draw from the situation was that Charlotte couldn't ambush Robin as long as she was at Chapman Farm.
I wonder what Strike would have done if Robin wasn't at Chapman Farm, if he would have said, hey, listen.
If he'd have called her and been like, guess what? My crazy ex is threatening me.
She's super jealous of you.
Yeah.
That would have been amazing.
She
would have been like, weird. Murphy's super jealous of you.
That's such a crazy
thing. So weird. It's almost like they have reason.
Amazing.
But anyway, I just love the mention of the door in this chapter with both their names engraved, because it's a reminder that even though Robin's away at the farm, they are partners. Nothing Charlotte could have done would have ever taken that away from him.
Is there a part earlier where Robin thinks about if Strike and Charlotte got back together, what would have happened? Yeah,
that's in Cuckoo's Calling. It's when Strike sleeps with Kara. He doesn't show up at work. And Robin says if his ex had taken him back, that wouldn't bode well for her job security.
Yes. I don't know what my point is, other than it's just Charlotte opened the door to Robin and she was never able to get in between Strike and Robin after that.
Oh my God. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Charlotte ran out the door and Robin went in the door, and then that door was shut behind her forever. The door to his heart. Which is now engraved with both of their names.
You've done it.
Connected the dots.
Let's go to our chat segment.
Talky talk.
We had a suggestion from a fellow Lindsay.
Yo.
That we call this the partner's chat or the partner's meeting.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
Of course it came from a Lindsay, right?
Well, we have the best ideas. Lindsay's have the obviously. Best ideas. Sorry, Ken's.
I agree.
Naturally.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm so excited for this week's partners chat.
Let's start with the request we got from Ash Stella Davo, I think is how you'd say that from Instagram.
That looks right. Ash Stella Davo.
Mm, you know what? You're probably right.
I don't think I am.
Me either. So that request was for book recommendations to fill the void while waiting for book 8. And I thought this was a great idea.
Yes.
You know how a while ago I said I don't really like fantasy?
Yeah.
I will tell you two fantasy series besides Harry Potter that I do really love.
Wow. Yeah, okay.
The first is Gregor the Overlander by Suzanne Collins, and she's the author of The Hunger Games.
Oh, yes, yes.
I hesitate to say that these are children's books because I think that turns some people off, but these are excellent. Mm-hmm. It's about a boy who discovers that there's a whole other world deep underground, and by accidentally traveling there, he's fulfilling an ancient prophecy about how the Underlanders will defeat their enemies. Oh, there are giant bats and rats, and spiders are not my favorite, but there are giant those two. And I believe there are 5 books in these series, and I really liked these ones.
Oh, interesting.
I liked these better than The Hunger Games.
I like Suzanne Collins. I like her plotting and world building and character and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I'd probably give those a try.
These are great. Yeah.
I did like The Hunger Games.
Yeah.
I like them enough.
Yeah.
I like Gregor better. Gregor is very sweet and uplifting and left me feeling good.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. Hunger Games doesn't.
Not so much. The other one is a little more obscure because I think I'm right that these might be self-published.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe. I'm not totally sure, but you can find them on the internet.
We're in like a self-publishing renaissance. There are a ton of really good self-published books.
I came across these books back in the Harry Potter days because the author was in some fan forums too. And then I completely forgot about them for years. And it was one night, I think it was in 2020, I was laying in bed and something just triggered the memory. And I was like, oh my God, I forgot about these books. And by then there had been more. So I reread all of them.
Nice.
It's called The Quest series by Lisa Wright DeGroot. And it's about another dimension that's being threatened by evil. And that's evil with a capital E because it's like its own character. So they bring people over from our world who they call the protectors to help fight it. And each book has a different protector and a different romance, but all the characters remain in the protector clan as it grows and the books go on.
I love stuff like that.
Yeah, I really love these books. My favorite protector is Tracy, and her love interest is a very large guard or something.
Oh, I'm shocked.
We're shocked.
I'm shocked.
Yeah, I think Tracy's book two, and okay. I love how their story continues throughout the series. It's great. I really love them.
Told me about these before.
I think I have.
And yeah. I meant to read them.
They're just a little tricky because you can't find them all in one place.
Yeah, you have to like hunt.
My last one is definitely in the crime mystery genre because that is my favorite genre to read. I recently read a book by Lisa Jewell called None of This Is True. Highly recommend this book to anyone who likes true crime podcasts because it's about two women who decide to make a podcast together and it ends up being a true crime podcast that they didn't intend to make about their own lives. It's unsettling in the best way. I don't want to say too much, but I haven't read anything else by Lisa Jewell, but I think that I'm going to because I really enjoyed this one.
Interesting. It's giving me slight Only Murders in the Building vibes.
They make a podcast about a murder?
Yeah, that happens in their building.
I have a feeling that's a little bit more funny than this book was. It is more
funny. Yeah. So this book is like the terrifying version?
I wouldn't call it terrifying, but it's definitely, it's a little dark and unsettling.
Oh, okay.
I enjoyed it.
Good recommendations. I like them. I'll go with mine.
Okay.
It was hard to narrow down.
Mm-hmm.
So I picked some of my favorites from this past year. My first pick, it's technically two books, but it counts as one because I say so. Gaudy Night and Busman's Honeymoon by Dorothy Sayers.
Classic.
These are the last two books that Sayers wrote featuring Lord Peter Wimsey and Harriet Vane. They're great golden age mystery novels. But the real reason you should read them and why I'm recommending them to sort of fill the gap is because of the relationship between the two main characters, the romance, mm-hmm. and also the incredibly, it has a really powerful inner journey of Harriet Vane that you explore. She struggles reconciling like her career and her independence as a woman with her romantic relationship with Wimsey, which is very great. So if you love Robin and Strike as sort of partners, best friends, and lovers, technically future, then you'll also, I think, love Wimsey and Vane. And Gaudy Night is set in a college in Oxford, and being set within academia lets the book explore some really fascinating philosophical and intellectual questions that I really enjoyed. And then Busman's Honeymoon is, I don't want to spoil it too much, but I will say that it is romantic and funny and a bit tragic. It's good. Actually, as a caveat, I will say that if you're going to read these, you should actually probably read Strong Poison and Have His Carcass first to understand it, because that introduces Harriet and then it sets up how the relationship has gotten to where it is in Gaudy Night. So technically that's four books,
mm-hmm.
but the first two aren't as good. Gaudy Night and Busman's Honeymoon are the really good ones. But the first two are quick reads, so you can power through them, get to the good stuff. I think Jo herself has said that she's a fan of Dorothy Sayers, so mm-hmm. you might be able to pick up some of like influences on the Strike books from these.
Yeah. It's interesting that you recommend these because I actually just got the first Peter Wimsey book.
Ooh, yeah.
I got it as an ebook and on audio because they're free on Audible. The first one is Whose Body?
Yes. Yeah.
So yeah, that's the one that I have. I mean, they're nice. 99 cents on Apple Books for the ebook, and then they're free on Audible. So why not? I figured that if I was going to give some J.K. Rowling influences a try, this might be more up my alley.
Yeah. I mean, mm-hmm. if you like mysteries.
Right.
Peter Wimsey was like the OG gentleman detective. He doesn't have to work. He just solves mysteries for funsies.
That sounds great.
You got to have a hobby. So. Yeah. So my second recommendation is Miss Percy's Pocket Guide to the Care and Feeding of British Dragons by Quimby Olson. This is a delightful, cozy fantasy set in Regency England. It's about Mildred Percy, who is a spinster who's given up on the idea of ever having any kind of adventure until one day she inherits a dragon egg, which is a very cute premise. There are a few things I love about this book that make me recommend it. The first is the narrative voice, which I think is original and clever and hilarious. So there's a lot of sort of a direct address to the audience from the narrative voice that's reminiscent of sort of a modernized Austen. And there are so many moments in Olson's books where these little authorial asides make me laugh out loud in the Miss Percy series is so good. The second reason is Mildred herself as a character. She is really beautifully drawn as a woman in her 40s who wakes up one day and realizes she's basically become a passive observer in her own life. She takes care of everyone around her with no thanks and has nothing of her own. Her story starts with a single small choice to keep something for herself. And then the journey that she takes because of that into her confidence, into her desires, into her adventurous soul. It reminds me so much of Robin's journey in the strike books. Like, she's becoming who she was meant to be, right? I really, really love that. And then there's a really adorable sweet romance in the books between Mildred and the vicar, Mr. Wigan. Mm-hmm. But I think the real love story is Mildred learning to love and care for herself. And also they're really cute baby dragons, which I'm a fan of.
Is that a standalone book or a series?
It's the first in the series of three. And then the third one is coming out this year. And I'm really excited.
I would try that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's fun. Anyway, so yes, recommend those highly. They're very cute. My third recommendation is The Buried Giant by Kazuo Ishiguro. So this is technically a fantasy novel, but it's not really what one would normally think of when they think fantasy. It's set in the dark ages of post-Arthurian England.
Do you like books that take place in England?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. I guess I do. Wow, I didn't realize that was a bit of a pattern, huh?
Yeah.
Calling me out like that. Oh my God. Wow.
Just an observation.
So a mist has settled on the land and it's taken people's memories of their past. It's taken their ability to form new long-term memories. So everything about who they are, where they've been, what they're doing there is a haze, and they're just living in the moment as if it's always been this moment. Well, there's this elderly couple, Axel and Beatrice, who have a vague feeling that they once had a son, but they can't remember. They think maybe he moved to a different village, but they don't actually know because they can't remember. So they set out on this journey to find their son. Reading this book, it's like trying to find your way through a fog, because the characters themselves have no real reference points for what's happening. So you are discovering the world through their eyes as they discover it, right? You're seeing small parts of what feels like a giant, enormous, mysterious, terrifying world, and you're trying to piece it together to understand what's happened to them, what's happened to this place. And the story that eventually unfolds is just, it's tragic and it's heartbreaking and it's really beautiful. And the love and care that Axel has for his wife Beatrice, it rips my heart apart and puts it back together basically every single page. And then the ending of the book absolutely destroyed me emotionally. So for me, this is one of those books where, so you finish it and then you just kind of walk around in a daze for the next week because you don't know what to do with yourself, because the story is, it's not something loose in your brain and you don't know how to fit it all back together. You know, like you're just been hit in the face by this book and you're like, what do I do now? It might not be to everyone's taste, because for a lot of the book, you have no idea what the fuck is happening. You just have to go along with it. But if you're interested in a really beautifully written story about trauma and love and loss and grief and desperately wishing to forget, but also knowing the importance of remembering, gotta read this and then come cry with me about it on Twitter. Also, apparently Guillermo del Toro is doing a stop motion animation adaptation of this. Mm. So that's going to be amazing.
When you mean it destroyed you, like a good way or a sad way?
Both. Simultaneously, both.
Okay. So my first one, and I have fools to thank for this one.
Oh, yeah.
So the first one is going to be a book called The Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society by Marianne Schaffer and Annie Barrows. If you want to get a taste for what the book's about, I would recommend watching the movie adaptation of it, because it is amazing. There's a great romance subplot. The chemistry between the two leads is amazing. But the story is about a woman named Juliet who is receiving these letters from residents in the island of Guernsey that are describing their lives during the German occupation of the island in 1946 and like the impact that it has on them. It's really good. Y'all know I'm a sucker for a good romance subplot. And thank you, Pools, for introducing that to me, because it was lovely.
You're welcome.
I haven't read this book, but I have. I actually have seen this movie.
Amazing.
I know. Wow. I know. But, you know, Matthew Good is in it. That's why I watched it. Because I like him.
Matthew Good.
Yeah, we do.
Yeah, I actually also haven't actually read the book, but I love the movie. It's so good.
So good.
Also, keep in mind, Guernsey equals peak romance. And what's near Guernsey? Sark.
Mm-hmm.
Right next to each other, basically.
Joe's Header is what we're talking about.
Good reckons.
My second book, and this one might not be for everybody, is going to be a book that I actually read for the first time when I was around 13. Definitely shouldn't have been reading it at 13. I'll say that. But yeah, I was definitely way too young to be reading this, because this book is slightly raunchy. But anyway, the name of the book is Lamb, The Gospel According to Biff, Christ's Childhood Pal, and it's by Christopher Moore. Hmm. I love everything this guy writes. I think that he's hilarious. But this book, as you can probably tell from the title, is a fictionalized account of a guy named Biff who grew up with Jesus, knew him before he became the guy that we're all familiar with. It's touching. It's a bit raunchy. It's really funny. Might want to avoid it if you're a Christian who doesn't like to joke about your faith. It got me in a lot of trouble whenever I was in junior high school because I went to like a super religious private school. And there's Christopher Moore did a lot of research into it. Yeah, there's a bunch of different stuff in there. It's very cool, very funny. I like a lot of stuff that this guy writes. So
I have attempted to read a book by this author once.
Not for everybody.
I don't know. I felt like I was being yelled at, if that makes sense.
I get that.
Yeah.
There are a few other ones by him that I really like. I also liked Practical Demon Keeping. That one was a good one. And Lust Lizard of Melancholy Cove. Those are probably my top three. And then for the last one, something that is also really funny, slightly less sacrilegious, is Hyperbole and a Half, Unfortunate Situations, Flawed Coping Mechanisms, Mayhem, and Other Things That Happened by Ali Brosh. I don't know if you guys remember that Clean All the Things meme that was popular around 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah, I remember her.
But yeah, that's the this is the lady that did that drawing. She just has a bunch of like her posts in a book.
I think I read this.
It's really, really funny.
Like I might have read this.
She actually has a sequel to this as well that I haven't read yet. But yeah, this book is so funny that I can't read it in public because it makes me laugh too hard.
I love books like that.
Right. There's this chapter in here where she talks about finding hope when she was in the middle of a really bad depressive episode that really helped me when I was in a bad place a few years ago. A lot of it is touching. It's funny. And yeah, definitely recommend if you're looking for something to make you less miserable and to make you laugh.
Who wants a book to make them less miserable?
Everybody. Every no. normal person.
No, we want books that make us miserable.
No, it's literally the opposite reason of why I read anything.
Okay, right. Fine. Looking at the title, I feel like I've definitely read this, Kems.
Is it a nonfiction?
Yeah, all of the posts that she has in this book are all based on her life, just all about different stuff that's happened to her. They're kind of crappily drawn, but like they're really fucking funny.
All right. That was fun.
Yeah. Those are, hopefully those work. Let us know if you read any.
Yeah.
We also have to do a quick update on our London challenge.
Right.
Right. Yes. I know we're all enjoying the group part of this and the app, right? Those are fun. How are you guys enjoying the cycling bit of it?
Good. Generally. Okay. Mm-hmm. It does make one feel good, I suppose.
The most reluctant.
Yes, it does result in good feeling. Mm-hmm. That's about all I can say for it. Yes, I do feel good after I do it.
That's good.
Mm-hmm. I still find it pretty unpleasant and boring to do the actual cycling part, but I'm doing it. The app helps motivate me hugely.
Yeah, it does.
Thank you for that. Everyone on the app, because I know y'all see me if I don't do it, so that makes me do it. Very helpful.
They do notice.
They do.
It cracks me up how when you post a picture...
I put the miles in it. You put the miles. I'm not lying.
You go into it just assuming that everyone's going to not believe you.
Yeah.
You're like, I have to prove it.
So like I take a picture of like what I'm watching while I cycle on the TV with like the distance right in the bottom of the frame so you can see.
It's just hilarious to me.
And I was doing a thing where I was like, I was watching the Eras tour as I cycled. So every picture you have to guess which song is on, right?
And we nailed it. Me and Ken's, we nailed it.
Yeah, between the two of us.
Well, I have to prove it because otherwise I could very well be lying.
Nobody would not believe you, I don't think.
Okay, y'all are not suspicious enough. Anyway, Kens, how are you doing? Probably better than me.
I've been loving it. I've been, whenever I'm cycling, I'm re-listening to Running Grave, which has been a lot of fun. I've been trying to do 30 minutes at minimum, you know, just to make sure that I'm being active. But sometimes if I'm coming up to the end of a workout and there's only like a few minutes left in the chapter, or that chapter is just like really good, then I'll end up cycling past that 30-minute time. So it's working out well.
Nice.
One thing I was also going to mention is pools. I too hate that people are right about how being active can help improve your...
It's fucking annoying.
So annoying. Yeah. I've been furious.
Everyone's like, oh, if you exercise, you'll feel better. It'll make you feel so good. Your mental health, your energy. And I'm like, God damn it. I hate it when people are right about that shit.
Hate it.
Makes me so mad.
So is this a good thing or a bad thing? Because you guys sound like it's a good thing, but you're angry about it.
Well, yeah, I am angry that it's good. It's complicated feelings.
I see.
I'm definitely going to do the Shire afterwards because I need the people to see me to continue to have it. Mm-hmm. I need it. So if anyone wants to get ready to join me when I eventually finish the London one,
yeah,
I'll let y'all know when, mm-hmm. when that's going to happen and we can start up a fellowship.
And I would like to do another UK-based one, mm-hmm. if anyone is interested in that.
Oh, and we realize that we have referral codes that will get you 10% off.
I know. I'm so sorry.
We're stupid for not figuring that out earlier.
I know.
But if you want 10% off a challenge, we have referral codes.
Well, yeah, let us know if you read any of those books. If you want to join our challenges, it's still, I think you could probably still do it. I'm about halfway done.
I'm nowhere near halfway. So join
okay,
it.
So there's still time.
In the back.
Yeah. And even once I'm done with it, I can still go on and look at the group and chat with people. So
nice.
Yeah. Okay. If you still want to do the London one, there's still time.
Lots.
There was still time.
Okay.
Okay. What are we doing next time, Ken?
All right. So next episode, we are doing chapters 62 and 63. The bulk of those two chapters are going to be Strike interviewing the Heatons and then thinking about the interview afterwards.
Oh, fun.
My God. But then after that.
After that, what chapter comes after 63?
Mm, it might be 64.
That is how numbers work.
It is. So.
You're a math genius, Lindsay.
Thank you.
Amazing.
I'm a little bit excited about it.
That'll do it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoy what you've heard, don't forget to follow us on social media. We're on Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr at the SE Files Pod. You can also contact us on our website at thesefilespod.com or email us directly at sefilespodcast@gmail.com. Thank you so much again for listening, and we hope to catch you next time for another episode of the Strike and Ellicott Files.